questions they started to unfold. The engineers had dragged Dr. Collyhole's great paper balloon up out of his attic workspace and spread it on the head's tar-paper roof. It looked like a giant's eiderdown, and it was growing plumper and cozier looking by the minute as hot air, pumped through special tubes from modified braziers, started to fill the envelope.
"Careful!" shouted Dr. Collyhole, bustling about like a rheumatic hen. For years he had been studying the possibility of flight, inspired by the discovery of the great complex at Heathrow to the west of London, from whose broad runways he believed ancient machines had once sped into the air. His own scrap paper invention looked hopelessly small and childish now compared to the great rusted bird shapes that archaeologists had uncovered there. He had only ever meant it to be a beginning, a first tentative step on the ladder that would carry men back into the sky. Now everything was suddenly rush and hurry, and Fever's life depended on him. He wished that he had time to go below and check his calculations one last time.
"Don't let the braziers burn too hot," he insisted. "We must not let the whole thing catch a blaze."
Godshawk's surviving notebooks were kept in a locked case deep in the stacks, as if even the Order of Engineers considered them dangerous. Dr. Isbister brought the key and kept watch over Fever and Dr. Crumb as Fever pulled out the notebooks one by one. The books were circular, like the one she had seen at Kit Solent's house, and with typical Scriven perversity their titles were written only on their front covers, not their spines. At last she found one that looked promising. On Stalkers, Godshawk had scrawled across its binding. Isbister had labelled it neatly, Volume 86. She pulled it down from the shelf and sat on the floor and opened the book on her lap, while Dr. Isbister fussily rearranged the other volumes she had upset in her search, and Dr. Crumb stood over her holding an electric torch. Its light fell upon page after page of intricate diagrams and Godshawk's tiny, crabbed handwriting. "He knew so much," whispered Fever, turning and turning the pages. Careful drawings traced what happened when a stalker brain was inserted in a corpse's skull. Weird, wiry tendrils unfurling to colonize the dead man's nervous system, wrapping like bindweed around the spinal cord. No wonder Godshawk wanted immortality. He could not just let all this knowledge vanish. He had to do something. She lost patience and began flicking through the packed pages, past images that jogged a cascade of memories, until she reached blank, empty leaves at the end. She flicked back and found the last picture in the book, a tiny object drawn life-size in a corner and again much larger in the middle of the page, the shape of a walnut, the size of an almond.
"That is the thing he showed me in the garden," said Dr. Crumb.
Fever flicked back through the final pages, but they were as blank as before. He lost interest in stalkers after he found that. It set him off on a new course, in a new notebook. Dr. Crumb went back to the shelf, almost shoving Dr. Isbister aside in his eagerness to grab the next volume. He came back empty-handed. "It's not there. Lost in the riots, I expect."
"Shh," said Isbister abruptly.
They fell silent, listening. From somewhere nearby came odd sounds. Crinklings, scratchings, tiny papery creaks. Mouse noises, not out of place among so many books and papers, but too deliberate somehow. The sound of someone or something keeping much too quiet.
"Have the rioters broken in?"
asked Fever, and the puzzle that had been coming together in her mind fell apart again. How could she think about her past when her future looked set to be so brief and violent?
"Who's there?"
called Dr. Crumb.
"Keep your voice down, Crumb. You're in a library,"
hissed Dr. Isbister. In the sudden silence, the sound of dust settling.
"We should leave," said Dr. Crumb.
"After first replacing the books,"
Isbister reminded him in a whisper. Behind the librarian, a white figure stepped out of an impossibly narrow gap between two bookcases. It was exactly the same size and shape as Fever.
"Dr. Isbister," she shouted.
"Shh,"
said the librarian, pointing upward at the silence sign that hung above them. The paper boy lunged forward and drew a needle claw across his neck.
"Ow!"
he shouted.
"I mean, ow!"
he whispered. He turned, but the paper boy's venom was already taking effect. Stumbling drunkenly, he crashed sideways into the shelves which held Godshawk's books. Glass starred and shattered, dropping with him in long blades as he slid to the floor, shuddering, choking, dead. The paper boy, with a tiny ripping sound, stuck out a second claw. Fever stared at it. She was remembering how it had felt to glue its two halves together and carry it out onto the roof to dry. She remembered how it had felt to lie on that paper while Dr. Crumb drew her outline around her. It was like being menaced by her own shadow. Dr. Crumb, more practiced than her in the art of keeping calm, just snatched a heavy book and threw it. The near-weightless paperboy was carried backward and trapped beneath the book as it thudded to the floor. Its arms and legs flapped helplessly. It rattled like a paper bag caught on a branch in a gale. "Come on, Fever!"
"But Dr. Isbister, he's dead, and if the rioters have access to the new council's store of paperboys, there may be many more of them in here with us."
Fever started to follow him between the stacks, and as she went she heard the awful sound of paper footsteps keeping pace with hers along a neighbouring aisle.
"How many do you think there are?"
"There were 7 in that last batch we made."
They rounded a corner in ancient history, and the paperboy rose up in front of them and stood there swaying like a cobra. Its claw lashed out at them, missed, and snagged in the leather binding of an old grimoire. Before it could free itself, Dr. Crumb grabbed it by its head and one shoulder and pulled as hard as he could. Paper ripped. The torn boy freed its claw and raked it across his coat, but it did not pierce the fabric. Dribbles of venom shone for a moment in the weave of the cloth. In another moment he had wrenched its head off.
Fever watched, surprised. She had never imagined Dr. Crumb doing such things. She would have to revise her whole picture of him.
"Fever!"
he shouted. She snatched up a big book to use as a shield. 2 more paper boys were rustling along the aisle. Fever turned and 2 more blocked the way behind her. They crouched and came creeping slyly forward while their flat white faces wove from side to side.
"Oh, Dr. Crumb!"
"They have her!"
screeched Thaniel Wormtimber, crouched in his chair, eyes on his screens and fingers on the paper boy's controls. Ted Swiney, standing just outside, bellowed, "They've got her!" And Charlie, who stood next to him, heard the news spread outward through the crowd.
"They've got her! She's cornered! She's dead meat now!"
None of them noticed the balloon inflating on top of Godshawk's head. Fever shoved a line of books from a shelf beside her, and the paperboys drew back, wary now of being trapped or torn. Dr. Crumb toppled a stack into the path of the 2 confronting him, and they went whispering away, circling round among the high bookshelves, looking for an easier way to reach their prey. Father and daughter stood breathing hard, listening to the rustlings and flutterings that the paperboys made as they crept along neighbouring aisles. Fever stuffed away her feelings and groped in her pockets, looking for something that might be of use. Usually she carried a small penknife, but she had left home that day in such a hurry that she had not thought to bring it. Instead, her hand closed on the box of matches that she had taken with her when she left Godshawk's vault. She took the box out. Dr. Crumb said,
"Fever, it would be most unwise to use fire against them here among all this dry paper and other flammable materials."
"Better unwise than dead," said Fever. She stopped and ripped a page out of one of the books she had thrown down, screwed it into a spill and held it between her teeth while she lit a match. Behind some nearby books, a rasp, a rustle, the dry slither of paper being slipped through a crack in the back of a bookcase. The match would not strike. Fever discarded it and tried another. Twice it scraped uselessly over the rough strip on the matchbox side, but on the 3rd attempt it lit, and she put down the box and held one end of her paper taper into the match flame. It flashed into fire at once, and just in time. Out from between some large, leather-bound volumes of journals on a nearby shelf, a paperboy's hand came groping. Fever scrambled away from it, holding the burning paper out in front of her. The paperboy slid his whole body out into the aisle and rose up quivering. Fever thrust the burning paper at him, and he drew back a little. She made another lunge, and again he fell back. "It works," she told Dr. Crumb. But just then the flames reached her fingers, and she squeaked and dropped the page. The paperboy started toward them again, but as it stepped over the fallen paper, a lemon-yellow flame stood up wavering among the books on the floor. The paperboy looked down as the flame spilled up its leg. It patted at the fire with its hands, but they caught fire too. Its legs crumpled into ash, and it curled backward and flopped to the floor, spreading flames to other fallen books. Fever raised a hand to shield her face from the brightness and the startling surge of heat. "Fever!" Dr. Crumb was shouting. She turned and he grabbed hold of her and dragged her along the aisle, stumbling over the spilled books there, the rising flames stretching their shadows ahead of them. What had she done? All those books, those thousands of pages, those millions of words, stacked up like tinder in the head. Sparks jetted into the shadows above the shelves. Flags of burning paper floated like gaudy jellyfish from aisle to aisle, spreading the fire. Another paperboy, his blazing arms windmilling, struggled toward the fugitives, leaving trails of flame behind him. He crumpled into drifting ash before he reached them, and his charred brain disc came rolling past Fever's feet like a spent Catherine wheel.
They reached Isbister's desk, and Fever snatched from behind it a long pole with an S-shaped metal hook on the end that Dr. Isbister sometimes used for opening the library windows in fine weather. She used it to flail aside a paperboy who had stationed himself between the desk and the door. He scrumpled, turned, and charged at her again, but she stuck the iron S through him, hoiked him over her head, and held him up like a marshmallow before the flames which now filled the library. He struggled for a moment on the pole's end, but then Dr. Crumb pulled the door open, and the inrush of air made the fire roar up fiercer and brighter than ever. Flames rushed across the ceiling, lapping over one another like waves of golden water. The paperboy charred and ignited, and Fever dropped the pole and ran.
Chapter 25. Heads Will Roll. There was fire on the roof, too, but it was controlled, directed fire. The balloon stood upright now. The engineers had attached a basket to the ropes that dangled from its sides. A brazier was bolted above the basket on a metal tripod, and the glow of the burning charcoal came softly through the paper, reminding Dr. Collyhole of the floating lanterns which used to drift across the city from the Godsawk place out in the marshes, and which had first led him to ponder the lifting properties of hot air all those years ago. Well, his project was ready now. It shifted and shivered. It took all the strength of his fellow engineers to hold it down.
"We're ready!" Dr. Staling shouted. "Where are Crumb and the girl?"
Kit Solent had fallen into a chilly half-sleep, crouched at the roof's edge in the wind. He was wandering in his memories of Katie and the children, and he felt desperately sad when Dr. Staling's voice roused him and he found himself back in the present, cold and stiff and in pain and trapped on a giant head. Smelling smoke, he glanced down over Godsawk's brow.
"What in the name of...
Dr. Staling! Fire!"
Godsawk's head blew a plume of white smoke out of either nostril. A jack-o'-lantern glow came from its eyes and lesser windows, lighting up the rioters below. When Fever and Dr. Crumb reached the roof a minute later, the tar paper was already beginning to grow tacky in the heat. The head let out weird metallic booms and groans, snorting dragonish showers of sparks which drifted across the crowds in front of it.
"Crumb, we cannot remain here much longer,"
shouted Dr. Staling, clinging to one of the ropes of the restless balloon.
"What will the rest of you do?" Fever asked, as Dr. Crumb helped her into the balloon basket, where Kit Solent already waited, reaching out to help her.
Dr. Collyhole fussed about, muttering about lift-weight ratios and checking the bags of ballast that were tied around the edges of the basket.
"We shall go down the fire escape and seek safety on the ground," said Staling. "People laughed when I installed a fire escape in this, Ed. They will not laugh when they see what an eminently rational precaution it was."
Fever rolled over the side of the basket and dropped in next to Kit. Instantly the basket slumped down onto the roof, where Fever felt it sink stickily into the liquefying tar. Smoke started to come up through the wicker floor.
"Dr. Collyhole, what is wrong?" asked Dr. Crumb.
Dr. Collyhole shook his head nervously.
"I must have miscalculated. We must shed some ballast."
Hurriedly, engineers fumbled with the knots that tethered the big gravel-filled sacks of ballast. One splodged down onto the melting roof, then another, and the balloon shifted and reluctantly began to rise, tethered to the roof only by a few thick strands of tar, which stretched like scorched toffee, and at last gave way. Fever gripped the edge of the basket with both hands and leaned out, shouting Dr. Crumb's name. He turned and waved.
"Good luck!"
"Steady on, Crumb," warned Dr. Wire. "This is no time for emotionalism."
"When you get there, tell them where you come from," shouted Dr. Staling. "Tell them you're an envoy from Staling and the engineers!"
The balloon rose unsteadily into the sky, and the crowd below saw it and greeted it with a hoarse, raw-throated roar. Bricks and stones were flung up at it, and a few guns went off, but the wind caught it and wafted it beyond their range. Looking down, Fever saw people streaming like insects through the narrow streets. She looked ahead and saw rows of tall tenements on the slopes of Clerkenwell Hill. The balloon was headed toward them, on a level with the chimney pots, and already the insect mob was swarming darkly up onto their rooftops, waiting with pikes and gaffs and guns for the wind to bring it to them.
"Kit!" she shrieked. "We have to go higher!"
She leaned over the edge of the basket and started to claw at the tight, wet knot that held the nearest bag of ballast in place. Kit did the same on the other side. She heard him shout with pain as his bag came free and he took its weight for an instant, wrenching his wounded shoulder. Then his was falling down, 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 and Fever's close behind it, smashing tiles from a roof down there, and the balloon lurched upward. At the back of the head, unnoticed, the engineers hurried down their spindly fire escape to safety, jumping sections where the steps had collapsed, scorching their fingers on the hot handrails, but stumbling out at last onto the rubbly ground. No one tried to stop or harass them as they opened a gate in the fence and scattered into the crowd. All eyes were raised skyward, watching the balloon, and most of the mob was streaming north as if hoping to catch it when it fell. Once he was a good distance from the head, Dr. Crumb turned to watch it too. He was feeling rather irrational that afternoon, and it seemed to him that Godshawk's head looked wonderful, lit from within by the glow of the fire, with firelight shafting out of every vent and window and the balloon rising palely from its crown like a thought bubble, one last idea wafting free in the updraft from that mighty brain. Someone seized him by the arm. He turned with a start to see Dr. Staling thrusting a filthy, flattened hat at him, cramming it onto his head. Behind him, the others of the order were almost unrecognizable under the hats and scarves and shawls of sacking which they had picked up from the littered ground and used to hide their bald, distinctive heads.
"Come on, Crom. This is no place for men of reason."
Just then, with an enormous noise, the timber props under Godshawk's chin gave way. There was a long groan, and the ground lurched.
The remaining crowd scattered backward, barging and trampling one another.
Worm Timber's chair, its bearers having fled, was left alone on the stretch of ground in front of the tilting head. Ted Swiney stood beside it, his angry little eyes still fixed on the balloon. Charlie pulled at his sleeve.
"Ted! The head! It's coming down!"
Ted looked up at Godshawk's enormous face, which glared back at him with flame-filled eyes. The timbers of the tram platform groaned as they took the whole of the head's huge weight.
"Jesus Christ!" Ted shouted.
It was the name of some obscure Cockney god, and knocked Charlie sprawling in his hurry to get away. Charlie got up, yelled a warning to Master Worm Timber, and ran after him. The Master of Devices opened his chair door and jumped out, just as the tram platform gave way and the head started to topple. He squealed, started to run, then realized that there was not time, and darted back inside the chair, slamming the door behind him. The head fell forward, slowly at first, and then very fast. It smashed the chair and all its contents flat with one colossal headbutt and hammered the splinters deep into London clay. Charlie dropped to the ground, overshadowed but not quite crushed by the curve of the statue's brow. The air was crammed with dizzy sparks and streaked by embers, thick with flung divots of earth and gobs of molten tar. Above it all, like panicked birds, the singed pages of 1,000 books danced on a tower of heat, and northward, all but forgotten, Dr. Collyhole's experiment faded into the pigeon-coloured clouds.
Part 2. Chapter 26. The Flight North. For a long time, Fever was terrified. Terrified of that gulf of air below her, and of the sparks and glowing scraps which gusted all around her, sometimes settling for a moment on the wicker of the basket or on the surface of the envelope itself. Terrified that lightning would leap from the ink-blot clouds above her and strike the wet balloon. Terrified that even if she survived the fall, she would come down among Londoners ready to tear her to pieces. But slowly, as the balloon passed over the low, scruffy streets of Finsbury and out above Hampstead's Heath, she was able to bring her feelings back under control. "Hot air rises," she told herself. The paper bag above her was filled with hot air, and it would bear her up until the fuel in the brazier was exhausted and the last of its heat given up to the cooler air outside, then set her gently down. Those were not thunderclouds above her. With luck, the fortunate wind would carry her and Kit Solent to the movement. She was safe. The balloon worked. One day, perhaps, people would sail the skies of the world in machines like this. Kit had slumped down against the basket side, and she busied herself with him for a while. His struggle with the ballast sack had tugged his wound open again, and she ripped a strip from the skirts of her coat and did her best to staunch the bleeding. Kit, barely conscious, groaned with pain when she moved him. She laid him on the floor of the basket and bundled the remains of her coat beneath his head for a pillow. "We must go back," he kept saying. "The children! Dr. Crum will take care of them," Fever promised. "They will be waiting to greet you when you return." She didn't think that was necessarily true, because she was not sure how Dr. Crumb was supposed to get halfway across London to find fern and ruin in the middle of a riot. But she could think of no other way to comfort Kit. "The movement will have doctors," she said, "and when you are better we shall go back to London. Think how happy fern and ruin will be to see you." "Katie," said Kit, finding her hand and holding tight to it. "Katie is not here," said Fever.
I am Fever Crumb. She wasn't sure that he had hurt her. He kept holding her hand. You'll look after Fern and Ruin, won't you? Of course, she told him, embarrassed. She was glad when he fell asleep. She hoped he would be more rational when he woke. She sat beside him and rested her head against the scratchy, creaking side of the basket. It was cold up there in the sky without her coat. She closed her eyes, wondering what had befallen Dr. Crumb and the other engineers. She wondered if he had made it safely to Ludgate Hill, and if Fern and Ruin were all right. Images of her terrible, unreasonable day kept flaring behind her shut eyelids. She felt exhausted. All her muscles ached. She thought, I must not fall asleep. Dr. Collyhole will want to hear my observations of this flight. But she slept, and memories came to her like the shards of something broken falling through her dreams. She was wearing a thick fur coat and standing on the heaving, creaking deck of a Sea Hoy as it plunged through grey waves under a snow-scoured sky. She was on an island in that same cold sea, standing before a savage, stately, fur-robed woman, surrounded by guards with spears and knobkerries. She was fetching out of her pack a metal tube, and out of the tube a precious sheet of ancient tinfoil, which she laid on the ground before the Queen's sealskin-shod feet as a gift and token of friendship. She was at home, in her own workroom, and Wavy Godsawk was fastening thick leather straps across her wrists, binding her to the arms of a heavy wooden chair. She could hear a steady thumping noise. Something was clamped tightly around her head, metal screws digging into the flesh of her brow and tugging at her hair. Hair? She thought. I don't have hair. She looked down at her trapped hands, and they were not her hands, but the hands of an old man, weathered and speckled. And she woke. It was the balloon, not a ship, that creaked and heaved. It was only a headache that pressed against her temples. She had been asleep, huddled on the basket's floor with her head on Kit Solent's shoulder. The fire in the brazier had gone out, and the balloon seemed to have shrunk a little, its sides dimpled and crumply. The thumping noise was still going on, interspersed with a lot of shriller crackles and bangs. Stiff, wet, and chilled, she stirred herself, reached out and took hold of the basket's brim, and levered herself up until she was peering over it. The rain had stopped, and the clouds were breaking up, allowing the evening sun to shine redly through. It lit up the ground not far below her now, not much farther than it would have been if she had still been on top of Godsawk's head. Flat, gorse-scabbed commons where the sheep scattered as the shadow of the balloon went sliding over them. Drainage ditches glistened in complicated patterns, like the mazes of silvery wire on ancient printed circuits. The city was far behind her. Ahead, a thick blanket of white smoke was curling over the orbital moatway like a slow-breaking wave. Darts of orange flame showed in the heart of it, and all around its edges there was movement, men running, and men on horses galloping, hurrying toward the smoke and away from it, so that the moatway seemed to seethe with secret motion like an ant's nest. Fever stared, her head still stuffed with dreams, trying to understand what she was seeing. And then, over the crest of the moatway, punching out of the smoke, a square shape came lumbering, scattering splintered stockade logs ahead of it, spraying up fans of mud as it slithered down the southern face of the embankment. Flame stabbed out of ports along its flanks. It was an armed and armoured land barge, and seeing it, Fever knew what was happening. The movement had made their move at last. They had attacked the orbital moatway, and they were breaking through. "Master Solent," she said urgently. "Kit!" He did not answer her. She twisted round to look at him, and saw that he was dead. "Master Solent," she said again, not wanting to believe it. She stared down at him, and she had no idea what to do. She knew that she must not give in to grief. Death was a natural occurrence. People who were sick or injured often died. It was a simple process of cause and effect, like the slow loss of heat that was making the balloon sink. But in this case it was a process that had begun with Kit Solent trying to protect her, and now he lay here white and still and uncomplaining, and Fever felt as though some veil had been torn aside and she was seeing the world as it really was, without illusion or comfort or consolation. He was dead. With a sound like a sharp sigh, a bullet hole appeared in the side of the basket close to Fever's face. She looked at it and wondered what to do. She did not even know who was shooting at her. Was it the moatway's defenders, taking her balloon for another of the movement's devices? Or was it the movement, assuming her to be a London spy? She crouched down, though she knew that would not save her. The bullets were just as likely to come through the floor of the basket as through its sides.
She felt more strike, chunking against the wicker like flung pebbles. If this many are hitting the basket, she thought, how many have hit the balloon? And she looked up and saw the paper envelope starting to sag and lose its shape. The bullets stopped. Whoever had been firing them had given up or fled. Fever crouched low and put her nose to the floor of the basket and peered through its weave. The ground was just a few yards below, lumpy, desolate ground, covered with long, pale grass, which soon began to brush against the underside of the basket. A few moments more and the basket touched down, striking against the top of a low ridge and dragging through the grass for several yards before lifting again. Fever clung on hard, shaken like dice in a cup. Kit Solent's body rolled against her knees, and she felt how cold and stiff he was. The basket touched down again. It landed harder this time, juddering violently as the balloon dragged it through stands of thistles and low clumps of firs. At last it tipped over and spilled Fever out. She landed hard in the coarse grass, rolling over and over. When she looked up, she saw the balloon billowing away from her, Kit's arm trailing from the basket. "Master Solent!" she shouted, as if he were still alive. She stumbled after the balloon. The crumpled envelope was itself touching the ground now, hissing over the furze tops with the basket trailing after it like a drag anchor. Fever caught up with it, grabbed the cuff of Kit's coat, and pulled him out. Freed of his weight, the balloon lifted a little, drifted away from her like a lazy ghost, and came to rest entangled in a line of trees a half mile away. Fever stood up and looked around. A riderless horse came galloping past, stirrups trailing. Far off to her right, a group of men in russet coats were struggling along a raised bank between the meadows, but they showed no interest in Fever or the crashed balloon. The long line of the moatway stretched across the land to the north. Smoke still hung thickly over the place where the battle had been, but she could no longer hear gunfire. She squinted at the smoke, making out the smashed outlines of the moatway defences and the shapes of men moving about among them. Movement men, presumably. The balloon had set her down among London's enemies. There was no time to ponder it, for the fall of the balloon had been noted. She had not stood staring long before she saw a small vehicle coming toward her out of the smoke. It was a mono, a single fat wheel with a cabin mounted on gimbals in its centre. She had heard of such things, but never seen one, since the powerful Guild of Sedan Chair-Bearers forbade motorised passenger vehicles in London. It bowled quickly across the heath, smoke squirting from its exhaust flutes, the evening light blinking from the windows of its hub cabin. It circled the wrecked balloon and then rolled toward Fever, stopping quite close to her. Two men jumped down from it and came toward her. They wore armour and marched with a heavy, merciless stride. When they drew closer, she saw that they weren't men at all, not any more. She swallowed and fought off an urge to run. She had forgotten that some of the nomad empires still had stalkers in their armies, dead warriors resurrected as armoured battle engines. The stalker's mechanized armor grated as it bore them toward her. From the eye slits of their faceless metal heads there seeped a thin green light. A wheeled tower, the symbol of the movement, was painted on their breastplates, and their names were stenciled in neat white lettering across their armored brows, Lammergeier and Corvus. Their hands sprouted blades. The one called Lammergeier pointed at Fever and said in a grinding iron voice, "Don't move! Put your hands up!" Fever hesitated, knowing that she could not obey both instructions. Put her hands up without moving? Dr. Crumb would have expected to point out to the stalker his faulty logic. But Dr. Crumb was not facing those ugly-looking steel claws. She cautiously raised both hands and stood there, feeling foolish, watching the machines approach. They went past her and stopped, looking down at the body that lay in the grass. "He's dead," said Fever helpfully. Then, remembering what Dr. Staling had told her as she left London, she added, "I am from Godshawk's Head. I am an envoy from the Order of Engineers." The stalkers stared greenly at her. They lowered their hands but did not sheath their claws. The one called Corvus said, "Are you damaged?" Fever shook her head. The second stalker pointed toward the waiting mono. "You will come with us. The Land Admiral will question you." The other stalker lifted Kit Solent's body and carried it to the waiting mono as if it were a sack filled with something not very heavy. They strapped him into a seat and motioned for Fever to get in beside him. She could not understand why they wanted him, but she was glad they were not leaving him out on the heath for crows to snack on. His head lolled against her as the mono set off. He smelled of blood and smoke and damp clothing, and Fever supposed that she must smell as bad. The odours seemed strong and out of place among the clean metal and leather smells of the mono cabin. But the stalkers did not seem to notice.
Chapter 27 Public Disorder. Ruin had never liked Mistress Gloomstove. He was only 7, but he'd always seen somehow what his father had failed to, that there was no real feeling behind the smiles and pats and pet names that she gave the children, that they were just a show she put on, because she thought that was how plump housekeepers were supposed to treat children, that she didn't really care for Fern or Ruin at all. In the middle of that noisy afternoon, when the mob came milling along the street, demanding justice and Kit Solent's blood, she proved him right. A housekeeper in her story would have stationed herself at the street door with a rolling pin, or perhaps a carpet beater, and told the rioters to clear off. Mistress Gloomstove simply said, "The master may think I'm your nursemaid, but he don't pay me enough to be your bodyguard as well." And she bundled up a lot of father's silverware in the best damask tablecloth, and hurried out by the back door. "But what are we to do?" asked Ruin, catching at her apron as she went. "How would I know?" the housekeeper snapped back. "Wait for your father to come home and deal with these people. It seems he cares more for that baldy-headed engineer girl than he does for either of you." "That isn't true," Ruin told his sister, who stood close behind him, clutching tight to Noodle Poodle and looking ready to cry. Ruin felt ready to cry himself, though he knew he mustn't. The air outside was full of strange, frightening noises, smashing glass and angry shouts. The sky had gone a funny colour, and it was full of smoke and the smell of burning. Ruin closed his eyes and held Fern's hand tightly and prayed to Posket, Lud and Mama Cellulite that his father would come home. But when he led his sister back through the house to see if the prayer had worked, they found no trace of Daddy. Outside, the growl of the crowd echoed off the barbican walls, gruff as a fairy tale troll. Ruin wiped his sleeve across his eyes and took Fern's hand again. The little girl was saying, "But what do they want, Ruin? What do those people want?" Ruin didn't answer her. He wasn't quite sure. All he knew was that he and Fern had to hide before the growling troll outside came in and got them. The linen closet or the living room curtains sprang to mind. They were both favourite hidey holes when he and Fern were playing hide-and-seek with Daddy. Then he had a better idea. He dragged Fern after him into the kitchen, where she watched him gather the provisions they would need. Some bread and jam, a big double handful of biscuits, half a fruitcake. He told her to wait there while he ran upstairs, but she came with him, following him like a shadow through the suddenly scary house. A brick punched through the landing window while he was busy gathering up his best toys and some of Fern's and their favourite red storybook. He bundled it all up, together with the food, in his bedspread, so Mistress Gloomstove had taught him something about making bundles, at least, and slung it over his shoulder. It was heavy, but not too heavy, and he liked the feeling of it bouncing against his back as he went quickly back downstairs, holding Fern's hand. He knew the way to the secret basement well. He'd often spied on Daddy when he went through the bookcase, and he climbed its shelves and found the little hidden button that opened it quite easily. But once he and Fern were on the other side and the bookcase had slid shut behind them, it occurred to him that if he had found it, then so might someone else. There was a huge bang, still frightening despite being muffled by the bookcase. Ruin didn't know that it was the sound of the front door being kicked in, but he knew that it meant something bad, and he understood the next sound he heard. The voices of rowdy, drunken Londoners rushing into his house.
"Ruin," said Fern. "Noodle Poodle's frightened."
"Hush, Fern," he told her in a whisper. "We've got to be quiet, like playing hide-and-seek. Quiet as mouses, all right?"
"Shh,"
said Fern. They stood in silence, listening. As the balloon carrying fever away from him faded into the haze of smoke and rain above the North Boroughs, Dr. Crumb parted from his fellow engineers in an alley near Oxfart Circus, where they had hidden from the crowds. Dr. Staling was intending to strike through Clerkenwell to the astrologer's quarter, and the others were inclined to go with him, intrigued by what he had told them about the old tech machine with which Madame Lakshmi kept in contact with the movement. But Dr. Crumb had a mission of his own which could not wait. He left them there and set off to fetch the Solent children. Scurrying through the riot-torn city toward Ludgate Hill, he felt as if he were running through his own memories. The sky above the rooftops was smudged with inky thumbprints of smoke again, and dead bodies lay in the road, well-to-do Londoners who had been dragged from their chairs and kicked to death by the rioters. The terrible roar of the mob, which he remembered too well from the time of the Skinner's riots, came rolling at him down this street and that, so that it was hard to know where the trouble was. The truth was, he decided, there was trouble all over town. The riot was confined to no single place. There were a dozen riots going on.
Some of the crowds who passed him were yelling about vengeance for Bagman Creech and death to the Dapplejacks, while others were demanding that the new council do more to protect them from the movement. Most, as far as he could tell, were just taking advantage of the general lawlessness to loot and rob and burn and bellow, safe in the knowledge that the trained bands had gone north to man the moatway and could not be called out to stop them. His best hope, as he reached Ludgate Hill, was that the mobs would have been too busy filling their pockets with the contents of the nearby tech shops to trouble themselves with Kit Solent's house. But as he drew nearer to it, he heard shouting and the smashing of glass, and realised that they had got there ahead of him. Fearing for the safety of the Solent children, he pulled his hat down tight to hide his shaved head and ran toward the noise. By the time he reached the house, the rioters had swept through it and away, bound for the Barbican, where there was better loot to be had. Kit Solent's door, kicked off its hinges, lay skewed on the hallway floor. Grains of glass crunched under Dr. Crumb's shoes as he crept cautiously inside. Someone had scrawled "Scriven Lover" on a wall. Things like dice skittered away from him at each step, and when he picked one up, he found that it was a worn letter H from an ancient keyboard. Solent's irrational house had been partly floored with the things, it seemed. He let it fall. The house was quiet. Upstairs, the light came pale and wintry through crazed windows. Dr. Crumb pushed open the door of one ransacked room after another, afraid of what he might find. "Children!" he called. Kit Solent had told him their names, but in all the excitement he had forgotten them. "Children!" Below him, Ruin and Fern watched the ceiling, listening to the noises that he made as he prowled about the house. At first, Ruin had felt glad when the terrible troll noises grew quieter. But in a way, this new, quiet noise was worse. It made him think that someone sly and dangerous was creeping about, looking for him and Fern, nosing into hiding places, maybe telling all the others to keep quiet so he could listen for the children's breathing. "Children!" they heard him call, but it was not a voice they knew. Not Daddy's voice. Ruin tiptoed to the door on the far side of the basement and tried it. It was not locked. There was darkness on the other side, and he was scared of the dark, but he was more scared of whoever else was in the house, and at least there were lanterns lying about. He took a match solemnly out of the matchbox which he found on a shelf, and carefully, carefully lit a lantern. A padding of feet way up above the ceiling somewhere. A crash of something overturned. He took Fern's hand. "Come on." "Where are we going?" "Somewhere where only Daddy will be able to find us. Only him and Miss Crumb know about this place." He tied the ends of his bedspread bundle across his chest, so that he had one hand for the lantern and the other for his sister. "It's dark in there," said Fern. "It's all right, that's what the lantern's for, and I'll take spare matches and spare candles in case it goes out." He stuffed them into his pockets as he spoke. Fern looked dubiously at the tunnel entrance. "Noodle Poodle's a little bit frightened of the dark," she said. "Then make sure you cuddle him up nice and tight," said Ruin. And he took her hand and picked up the lantern, and they went together into the tunnel. "Children!" called Dr. Crumb, one last time into the quietness of the empty house. He knew there would be no answer. The children must have fled or been taken. He sat down on the bottom step, tore off his hat, and held his head in his hands. There was a dream that Dr. Crumb had often dreamed when Fever was a baby, although it had come to him less and less frequently since she learned to walk and talk. In the dream, he was already dead. He had died in his sleep, and through some calamitous coincidence, everyone else in the head had died too. Only baby Fever was left. She woke up crying, and there was nobody to hear her. She scrambled out of her plan chest drawer and came and cried at Dr. Crumb's bedside and clutched at him and tried to wake him, but he could not wake. He was dead, and Fever didn't understand. How could she? She was only a baby. What could she do? How would she find food? How would she find help? He used to wake up in a panic, wondering what would become of her, alone and confused in the wide world. He felt the same sort of panic now, imagining what might have befallen Kit Solent's children. It took him some time to control himself and stow his emotions away. When he was ready, he walked out calmly into the street, meaning to find his way back across the city to where the other engineers were waiting. He was almost at the corner of Cripplegate, when he realised that he had left the Solent house without his hat. It must still be lying where he had thrown it, in the wrecked hallway. He was just wondering if he should turn back for it, when a rough voice shouted, "It's another one of them! Grab him, lads!" Dr. Crumb started to run, but in his panic he ran the wrong way, straight into the hands of the rioters. They grabbed and pinioned him. They lifted him off the ground. They jostled him around a corner and into the midst of a small crowd, and when he looked about he found that he was surrounded by his fellow engineers, all prisoners too.
"Crumb," said Griffin Wire. "They caught us on our way out of Madame Lakshmi's tower. Perhaps we would have been less conspicuous if we had not all gone en masse. A most unreasonable woman, Crumb, but what equipment she possesses. Radio, I believe the ancients would have called it. If that is an example of the movement's technology, Staling is right to side with them."
Dr. Crumb found that he was not remotely interested in Madame Lakshmi or her radio. He was more inclined to wonder why the Order had been seized and why their grimy captors were shoving them uphill toward the Barbican.
"What do they want with us?" he asked.
Wire shrugged, but one of the roughs walking alongside overheard him and said, "You're needed at the Barbican, mate. Wormtimber's got himself squished, and the mayor needs somebody who understands the old machines."
"If Gilpin Ween needs our help," protested Dr. Crumb, "he could simply have requested it like a civilized man." "Who said anything about Gilpin Ween? He's finished. It's Ted Swiney who's running this city now."
Chapter 28. Under New Management. Ted Swiney hadn't meant to get himself a city that day. Everything was happening faster than he'd planned, thanks to Bagman Creech and the Patchskin Girl. But the mob that surrounded Godshawk's Head and went storming up Slaughtergate afterward to loot the fine houses on Ludgate Hill and seize the Barbican, well, they needed a leader to look to, didn't they? "Swiney," they chanted, as they harried the frightened old councillors out of their homes. "Swiney," they bellowed, ducking poor Gilpin Ween in the horse trough outside the Barbican. "Swiney for mayor!" A few tried yelling for Charlie Shallow, him being Bagman Creech's heir and all, but Charlie looked too young to be a mayor. Anyway, they didn't know his name, and yells of, "Bagman's boy, you know, the little skinny one with the hat," didn't sound half so good as "Swiney" when they echoed back at you off the Barbican walls. So they shouted for Swiney, and when the doors of the Barbican finally gave way and they surged inside, it was Swiney whom they carried shoulder high, and Swiney whom they set down upon the ornate plastic and chromium throne of the Lord Mayor of London. Swiney took it in his stride. He had a few of his trusty lads with him, Bricky Chapstick and Mutt Gnarly and that crowd from the Mott and Hoople. Prowling around the mayor's apartments, he examined silver ornaments and squinted uncomprehendingly at antique paintings. Someone had fetched up a crate of vintage Frankish wine from the mayoral cellars, and he had a swig of that, but it tasted foreign, so he sent a few lads down to his brewery for a keg of decent London beer. A few more were dispatched to find engineers. There was a lot of old tech junk plonked on pedestals around the place, and he'd need somebody to tell him what it was worth. The rest of the lads he sent out to start quelling the riot. He'd been happy enough to see High London trashed while it belonged to old woofters like Ween, but now that it was his, he wanted it to come through the night without being burned down. Mutt and Bricky and their mates knocked some heads together and filled some others with dire visions of what happened to people who got on the wrong side of Ted. Slowly, like a big, bad-tempered animal settling back to sleep, the brief disturbances wound down. It had been a little riot by London standards, with barely 100 people killed and only a half-dozen buildings burning somewhere down Cripplegate, but in its aftermath a carnival feeling filled the city. Happy looters gathered in the big square in front of the Barbican, clad in other people's hats and stolen ball gowns and tattered curtains ripped from the mansions of former councillors. The rain had stopped. In the smoky, slanting sunlight of late afternoon, they waited for their new Lord Mayor to make his first proclamation. Ted Swiney swaggered out onto the mayoral balcony, high above the throng. He'd buttoned his shirt up and tied his mean little bow tie tight around his neck, which made his face redder than ever. "Swiney!" hollered the crowd. Ted looked down at their upturned faces, smeared all across the square below him like the pattern on a carpet. A dim, rare doubt swam into his mind. How did you run a place like London? He had already sent the former councillors off to douse the fires, so he couldn't ask them. But then his usual confidence returned. He might not know how to run a city, but he knew how to run a pub, all right. How different could it be? He turned and said something to Mutt and Bricky, then looked at the crowd again and raised his fists for quiet.
"Right," he bellowed. "First off, this gaff's under new management. You..."
And here he turned to poor, wet Gilpin Ween, whom Bricky had just hauled out onto the balcony.
"You're barred! Get out of my town and don't come back!"
He waited till Ween had scurried off and the mob's delight had quieted down a bit.
"Right,"
he said, straightening his tie.
Dealing with the old man had given him time to think about his own policies. What would his administration stand for?
"Here's some new rules for you," he said. "From now on, no toffs, no misshapes, no foreigners, no spitting. Karaoke every Tuesday night here at the Barbican. And live sports. Let's get Pickled Hill Circus rebuilt and have some proper fights again."
A fond memory wafted back to him of the days when he had been the hero of Pickled Eel, using his fists and his wits to bludgeon flat all comers. He ought to get a mural done of himself, he thought, 40 feet high in his fighting togs, all up the side of the Barbican. But he wouldn't announce that yet. What he needed was something that would please the crowd.
"And first off," he hollered, "since we've all had a busy day, I expect we could all use a beer."
Throughout his speech, the crowd had heard a rumbling, low and hollow, growing louder. Now, down Catamole Street and around the prow of the Barbican, there came trundling an enormous barrel, rolled up the cobbled hill from Swiney's Brewery in St. Kiley, by Mutt Gnarly and a regiment of eager, boozy helpers. The crowd parted to let them manoeuvre the huge keg to a spot below Ted's balcony, where they heaved and strained and manhandled it, and finally managed to lift it up on two timber trestles. More men appeared, pulling a dray heaped high with mugs and tankards. Mutt used a lump hammer to drive a tap into the barrel, and drew off a pint of foaming amber beer, which he raised toward Ted while the rest of the crowd cheered.
"Brimstone best," yelled Swiney above the din. "A barrel of my finest, big enough for all. Usually I stick a rusty horseshoe in each keg to give it a bit of bite, but this one's so big I had to use an anvil. So get stuck in. The first pint's free, and after that it's half price till dawn. It's happy hour."
And so it was. It was the happiest hour of Ted Swiney's entire reign. He leaned on the balcony and watched his followers get drunk, and the same half-contented, half-contemptuous look came over his face that he wore when he was standing behind his own bar. "Stupid clutes," he muttered to himself. "Booze and circuses, that'll keep 'em quiet. This maring lark was going to be a doddle." But then, above the gusts of raucous singing that wafted from the square, he heard a new sound, softer and yet more menacing than the shouts of the drunken prentices fighting and spewing in the streets below. A rumble and a roar it was, like beer kegs trundling into some vast cellar far away. Ted had never heard that sound before, but he knew it meant trouble.
"What's that?"
he asked Bricky Chapstick, but Bricky, too full of brimstone best, just said,
"You're my best mate, you are,"
and fell over on the carpet. Ted went and found a window and looked out of it. Northward, where the dim line of the moatway stretched across the hazy heath, big lazy clouds of smoke were starting to sprawl across the land, and pulses of light kept flapping and flickering inside them, red and gold and white. Even the revellers in the square had noticed it by then.
"Shut up," they told each other. "No, what's that? Shut up! Listen!"
The sound came only dimly to them even then. Crackling volleys of musketry, the whoop of unlikely old energy weapons, and the deep, steady kettle-drum boom of nomad cannon. Chapter 29. The Traction Castle. The mono was an inefficient, fuel-hungry mode of transport, but it was fast. Fever looked out of the windows as it went rolling past the wrecked balloon and curved toward the breach that the movement had made in the moatway. As it climbed the steep bank, she saw stalkers at work there, pulling down the shattered palisades and heaping up the bodies of dead London soldiers. One of the movement's armoured land barges was perched amid the ruins of a fort on the crest of the embankment, and she pressed her face close to the glass as the mono rolled past it, trying to peer between its armour plates to see which sort of engine it used and whether it had wheels or tracks. Hatches on its hull were open, and men in steel helmets and shining chainmail vests were sitting on its upper works. Before she could make out much more, the mono was careering down the steep northern face of the moatway, crossing the nettle-filled dike in front of it by means of a makeshift timber bridge. She could see other smaller vehicles on the land ahead, and behind them something so high and dirty and pale that she thought it might be the snout of a glacier. Could the ice really have come so far south? And then she looked again at the thing, and slowly it rearranged itself in her mind until she understood what it was. It was a traction fortress, the great capital vehicle of the movement, armoured in timber and metal, painted in dirty whitish dazzle patterns which must have served as camouflage while it was lumbering across the ice wastes. Watchtowers and gun emplacements encrusted its hull, their hard edges softened by swags of camouflage netting. Huge studded barrel-shaped wheels showed dimly through the mist that hung about its skirts, the mist which was not mist at all but vapour from its hundreds of chimneys and exhaust stacks. "It must be 100 feet tall," breathed Fever, peering up at its high prow, where a carved wooden dragon's head reared up, irrational, brutal, and stained red by the evening sun. The stalkers, of course, did not reply. In the fortress's flank an armoured gate stood open, and the mono rolled through it, up a ramp and into a hangar where a dozen others like it stood waiting, or were being refuelled by crews of mechanics. Many of the machines had names, like Rolling Thunder or the Wheel Thing, but before Fever had time to take in any more details, Lammergeier and Corvus were ordering her out of their mono. They marshalled her through a bulkhead door and up a spiral staircase, through more doors, along a passageway. The wooden walls and the low wooden ceilings were all carved with serpentine patterns and the stylized forms of the gods and heroes of the Old North. Fever and the stalkers crossed a chamber where a huge cannon and its crew stood ready at an open gunport, and passed into another, more richly decorated, where evening light came through a score of slit-shaped windows to stripe the hanging tapestries and polished deck. A man who had been sitting in a big chair there rose as she entered. There were others in the room with him, armoured warriors with swords and guns hanging from their thick belts, women in fur-trimmed robes, but Fever knew at once that the man in the chair was the important one, and she paid no attention to the rest. "The balloon has been secured," said the stalker Lammergeier. "One of its occupants is dead, but this girl continues to function." The man walked all round Fever with his hands folded behind his back, looking at her as if she were an exhibit. "I am the Land Admiral Nicola Quercus," he said. He had the faintest trace of an accent. His eyes were narrow, slanted, and stone-grey. He wore a shabby, tall-collared tunic, breeches and boots. He didn't look like a warrior. He looked like a scholar, a mild young man, not big or tall, with fair hair cropped short and brushed forward around his high forehead. "I am glad to see you safe, Miss Crumb," he said. Fever could not hide the surprise she felt, that he should know her name. Quercus laughed softly. "Don't worry. I am not a sorcerer. My agents have been in touch with Dr. Staling and keep me informed by means of technomancy. It was a bold move of the engineers, putting you aboard that flying machine. Luckily he was able to warn us that you were coming. I am sorry about your companion, Master Solent."
"Solent," said Fever. "He died saving me. He was very brave."
Quercus nodded. "His soul is in the high halls, then." Fever thought she should tell him that there were no such things as souls, then decided that she had better not. "He will be treated with honour," Quercus promised.
"He's dead!"
"Nevertheless, we have certain rites and rituals with which we honour the bodies of the courageous dead, here in the movement." Fever bit her lip, and supposed she should feel grateful. Funeral rites were silly religious nonsense, and it seemed pitiable that a man like Quercus should believe in gods and souls and rituals. But Kit Solent had not been an engineer. She remembered the candles under Katie's portrait in his drawing room, and thought that perhaps it would have comforted him to know that the movement would treat his remains with ceremony. Quercus nodded, dismissing the matter. He held out his arm to Fever. "Come, I must take you to meet the Snow Leopard."
"Who?"
"My chief technomancer. We call her the Snow Leopard. You know her perhaps by a different name, as Wavy Godsock."
"My mother,"
said Fever, suddenly hesitant, afraid.
"But that's—"
She stopped herself. She had been about to say, "That's impossible," but it was not impossible. When Dr. Crumb told her his story, she had recognized that there must be a chance Wavy had survived. She had accepted that she might have a mother somewhere in the world. She just had not expected to have the question resolved so soon. It was one thing to have a theoretical mother, quite another to be asked to meet her. Quercus's smile grew broader as he watched the expressions flit across her face. "Come. She waits for you." How long had it been travelling, that fortress of the movement? Even the movement had forgotten. Back when they were first driven from their homeland by ice and enemies, it had been the ox-drawn wagon of their chieftain. It had grown as they moved on, acquiring first steam and then petrol engines from the cities that they conquered, putting on turrets and funnels, gun decks and cabins, spires and jaws and sally ports. It was too big now to be powered only by its primitive engines, and its underdecks were filled with massive treadmills, worked by regiments of slaves. But still the movement recalled how, long ago, they had lived in Arctic oak forests during some brief lost era of warmth, and worshipped the gods and spirits of the trees. They had brought one tree with them on their journeyings, age-old, long dead, to remind them of their origins. It stood in a chamber of its own, near the castle's stern, a place which seemed quiet even when the engines were pounding and the big guns boomed. Centuries had passed since it last bore leaves or acorns, but the stumps of its branches were decorated with thousands of little scraps of coloured rag, the funeral ribbons of everyone who had died during the movement's wanderings. Beneath the oak that evening sat a woman. She wore one of the simple gowns that movement women favoured, a grey gown that left her throat bare, and displayed a curious sepia birthmark beneath her ear, and another in the hollow above her collarbone, like a puddle of spilled ink. Nervously, her long hands rose to tuck her hair behind her ears. Then she changed her mind and untucked it again. Her hair was grey-white, the colour of wood ash. There were faint crow's feet at the corners of her eyes. In every other way, she looked just as she had on the day that Gideon Crumb rescued her from the crowd in St. Kylie. Years lay lightly on the scriven. One of the big oak doors at the chamber's end opened. The girl came in, and Nicola Quercus came in behind her and softly shut the door again. "Fever Crumb," he said. Fever and her mother looked at each other. "Fever," said Wavy Godsawk, after a little while. She had thought of Fever often during the years since she fled London, but she had always pictured her as a little girl, like the little girl she had once been herself. She had not prepared herself to meet this spindly teenager, with her shaven head and her strange, familiar face. "My child," she said, after a little longer. "You have grown up," she said, wondering. "What have you done to your hair?" she asked. Chapter 30 The Snow Leopard. "My mother," thought Fever numbly. She went toward her, but did not take the slender hands that Wavy Godsawk stretched out to her. "My mother." She could smell her perfume, a subtle blue-grey scent that matched her dress. And what a strange face she had. It wasn't just those few small speckles. The cheekbones were too high, the eyes too large, the jaw too long, the wide mouth filled with far too many teeth, though very straight, thanks to the brace she'd worn when Dr. Crumb had met her. It was easy to see why people had believed that the Scriven were a new species. It was easy to see why the Scriven had believed it themselves. "She isn't human," Fever kept thinking. "And she is my mother." "You could have sent word," she said. "Dr. Crumb doesn't even know that you're still alive." "I thought it better not to," said Wavy Godsawk. "What good could it have done? I could not return to London alone. I had to wait until Quercus was ready." "Sit, my dear, sit." She patted the bench and Fever sat down beside her. She reached out and touched Fever's face, smoothing a thumb over her lips, brushing a smut from her forehead. Fever flinched away from her touch, feeling an irrational anger build inside her. What right did this stranger have to prod and stroke her, as if she was a pet or a doll? Wavy Godsawk sensed her feelings. "Oh, Fever," she said, sitting back and folding her hands in her lap, smiling. "Oh, but you must think me a terrible mother. To abandon you. To abandon your father before he even knew that he was a father. But I had to abandon him. Godsawk was furious when he found out I was in love with Gideon. He sent Gideon away, and he told me that if I tried to contact him, he would be killed. He sent me away, too, said he couldn't stand the sight of me, and packed me off to live at the Barbican. Then, when he learned that I was going to have a baby, he softened. I think that he had long been wanting me to have a child who would continue the house of Godsawk. He had spent years finding a good husband for me, and when Odo Bolventor rejected me, perhaps he was glad that Gideon Crumb had been there to provide him with an heir. But still he would not let me contact Gideon." Fever could picture her as she had looked in those days, the way she had worn her hair, the clothes she'd favoured. She had no memories of Wavy from her own babyhood, of course, but there were other memories, scores of them, from earlier times. Wavy as a little girl and as a young woman. Wavy in her white coat, her hair tied back, careful and serious and the best laboratory assistant a man could ask for. Wavy fastening those thick leather wristbands, frowning as she tightened the screws of the helmet around Fever's head. "No, not my head, not my wrists. These aren't my memories." Wavy kept on smiling at her, and reached out impulsively to touch her hand. "You were never comfortable in my womb, Fever dear. There was some mismatch between your human and your Scriven halves. How you struggled and squiggled. Elbows and heels jabbed me. I was feverish always. You arrived early one spring night in my apartment at the Barbican, long before you were looked for. A small little purple monkey you looked, barely longer than my hand, and the Scrivener hadn't made even one single mark upon you. Nobody dreamed